KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump meets with the leader of El Salvador, where the White House sent migrants is accused of being gang members. Will Trump ask for the return of a Maryland dad sent there by mistake? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Nearly 2,000 of the country's top scientists say the Trump administration is carrying out a wholesale assault on U.S. science. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. But were all scientific theories supported before this administration came to power? Also, how Trump's plan to deploy military to the Mexican border is playing out in West Texas. It's Monday, April 14th. On this day in 1902, James Cash Penney and several partners opened a dry goods store in Kemmerer, Wyoming. A few years later, he bought them out and named his company J.C. Penney. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. Social media giant Meta Platforms is expected to face off in court today against the Federal Trade Commission. At issue, whether Meta's killer acquisitions of Instagram and WhatsApp should be unraveled. Rachel Miro of member station KQED has more.
The FTC launched this antitrust investigation during President Trump's first term. Since the start of Trump's second term, Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg has visited the White House three times. Even so, Lee Heppner, senior legal counsel for the nonprofit American Economic Liberties Project, says he expects this trial to start on schedule.
Nothing's outside of the realm of possibility. I mean, we've been suffering from whiplash with this administration, and predictability is not on the table in our political system today.
In a statement, a Meta spokesperson wrote that Meta faces plenty of competition from other platforms like TikTok and YouTube. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Miro.
El Salvador's President Bukele is slated to meet with President Trump at the White House today. This as the Trump administration provided its first update on the status of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, a Maryland man mistakenly deported to El Salvador by the administration. Late last week, the Supreme Court ordered the administration to begin the process of returning him to the U.S., though it left the main decision-making of the case with a federal judge. Attorney Benjamin Osorio, part of Abrego's legal team, spoke to ABC News.
I anticipate that the press is going to ask President Bukele questions about Mr. Abrego and whether or not he's willing to return him. So I'm interested to see his responses there. I mean, since he was coming up from El Salvador, he could have put him on the plane with him. But obviously, that's not going to happen.
A federal judge has ordered daily updates on Abrego's status from the government. British authorities are racing to keep the country's last steel plant functioning. With the Trump administration's tariffs on steel and the subsequent threat of global trade wars, Britain is trying to salvage its domestic production. NPR's Lauren Freyer has details.
Two blast furnaces at a plant in Scunthorpe, northern England, are the only things keeping British domestic steel production alive, and they actually belong to a Chinese company. British lawmakers were recalled to Parliament from their Easter break this weekend and passed an emergency law giving the government temporary control of Britain's last steel plant. Amid suspicions its Chinese owners might shut it down, sell it for scrap, and force this country to rely on Chinese steel imports. The death of domestic production suddenly looks more risky amid tariffs and trade wars. If the blast furnaces in Scunthorpe fall below a certain temperature, they cannot be revived. So British officials are rushing coal fuel to them as they weigh whether to nationalize them altogether. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Wall Street Dow futures are up over 400 points. This is NPR News in Washington. In Ecuador, President Daniel Noboa has won re-election. The conservative young millionaire is known for his tough stance on crime. The nation's election council reports he received almost 56% of the vote. This morning in West Texas, Blue Origin, the private space company founded by billionaire Jeff Bezos, will launch the first all-female space flight since 1963. NPR's Ava Pukach reports pop star Katy Perry is a member of the six-person crew set to launch in the coming hours.
In an interview with the Associated Press, Perry says she feels honored to be a part of the crew, saying the flight is an important moment for the future of commercial space travel.
I am talking to myself every day and going, you're brave, you're bold, you're doing this for the next generation to inspire so many different people but especially young girls to go, I'll go to space in the future.
The trip will last roughly 11 minutes from liftoff to touchdown. The crew will experience several minutes of weightlessness and microgravity. This is the 11th human spaceflight for Blue Origin's New Shepard program. Ava Pukach, NPR News.
History was made at the Masters Golf Tournament in Augusta, Georgia, as Northern Ireland's Rory McIlroy became only the sixth person to capture golf's Grand Slam. For more than a decade, the Masters was the only one of the four major tournaments he had not won. His lead had seesawed, and at the end, McIlroy missed an easy putt on the final hole, but he took the championship in a sudden-death playoff. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Coming up, a man has been charged with setting fire to the home of Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro.
But first, El Salvador's leader is expected to meet with President Trump at the White House later today.
Yeah, Nayib Bukele is the man the Trump administration paid to imprison hundreds of people deported from the U.S. and accused of being gang members. El Salvador got about $6 million in that deal. Those deportations are facing numerous legal challenges in the U.S. Bukele is no darling to human rights organizations because he's imprisoned thousands of his own citizens with no due process. He's called himself the world's coolest dictator.
To hear more about this, we're joined by freelance reporter Manuel Urueda. He's following all this from Medellin, where you can hear that it is pouring rain, but hopefully he's indoors. Good morning, Manuel.
Good morning.
So this is the first leader from a Latin American nation to get an official invitation to the White House in President Trump's second term. What is Trump trying to get out of this meeting?
Well, in Latin America, the Trump administration has been looking for allies that will help it to deliver quickly in its priorities. And in this case, it's the effort to reduce immigration to the United States. In March, El Salvador took in more than 200 Venezuelan migrants who were accused of being gang members and were deported from the U.S. in an expedited and controversial fashion. Bukele put them in a notorious prison known as the CECOT. There have been more deportation flights like that since then, the latest on Sunday. During this visit, both sides might talk about how to expand those kinds of partnerships, including the possibility of sending some U.S. prisoners to El Salvador to be incarcerated there.
So this has obviously been hugely controversial in the United States. Has there been any pushback in El Salvador about this kind of deal?
Well, in El Salvador, Bukele is a hugely popular president, and many people don't mind his prison system. That's because El Salvador used to be one of the most violent countries in the world, with fighting between gangs controlling daily life in many communities. But in 2022, Bukele declared a state of emergency, which is still ongoing, that gave the police the power to arrest anyone they suspect of being a gang member and lock them up for months at a time without any kind of due process. Since those policies began, the number of homicides in El Salvador fell by 75%, and gangs lost their grips on many communities where they were taxing local businesses. Of course, human rights groups have been very critical of these tactics, and now their concern is that people who get sent from the U.S. to El Salvador will basically be treated in the same way that local prisoners are treated and disappear into the system. Last month, a Maryland resident, Kilmar Abrego Garcia, was sent by mistake to El Salvador. The Trump administration admitted it was a mistake. His family hasn't been able to get in touch with him yet, despite the Supreme Court's insistence that he should be brought back. On Sunday, the Justice Department said the courts had, quote, no authority to force El Salvador to release Abrego Garcia. So the question now is if Trump will discuss with Bukele the return of this Maryland resident.
And what about Mr. Bukele? What might he be looking for in this visit?
Well, I think one big thing is that this gives him the validation of the United States, something that helps Bukele to dismiss the criticisms he gets from human rights groups at home. By shoring up relations with the Trump administration, Bukele might also be trying to reduce tariffs on El Salvador's exports. El Salvador is the U.S.'s main trading partner. They send about 30% of their exports to the United States.
That is freelance reporter Manuel Rueda. He's reporting from Medellin. Manuel, thank you.
Absolutely.
The next round of trade negotiations could decide whether some U.S. tariffs remain on pause or whether even higher ones get imposed. The administration says the pauses are meant to give space for negotiations. But our next guest is one of the people who says all of this back and forth just raises more questions about the U.S.'s reliability as a trading partner and ally. And that's just one reason he argues that these tariffs are doing more harm than good. That guest is Richard Haass. He's president emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's been writing about this in his Substack newsletter, Home and Away, and he's here now. Good morning, Mr. Haass.
Good morning.
So just to recap, after imposing large tariffs on most countries, the administration announced a 90-day hold on much higher tariffs for most U.S. allies, and then they announced a pause on import duties for electronics like phones, computers, and semiconductors. Now, the administration is insisting that this is just part of President Trump's negotiations. How do you read this?
If it's a plan, it's not obvious to me or anyone else, either if you're a CEO or if you're the head of another government. It really looks incoherent. We don't have a clear sense of what's the rationale for the tariffs. It's not clear whether they're means to an end or ends in themselves. The exemptions now look arbitrary. They're a field day for lobbyists and potentially corruption. But again, it's just impossible to plan. And I think it's going to drive other governments away from trading with the United States to look for other more dependable trading partners.
I'm thinking about that walk back on electronics. One point you made in your Substack is that many leaders will just judge that President Trump has a low tolerance for pain. So what impact could that have?
Yes, it's interesting. He's famous for, quote unquote, the art of the deal. But you can always get a deal if you're prepared to compromise. And the fact that these tariffs have been put on and already there's lots of walking back creates the impression that if the United States is forced to pay a price for its policy, it will back off. This could have implications not simply for these 90-day negotiations you mentioned on tariff levels, but also could have implications, say, for the Iran talks that just got underway Saturday, or for the United States and Russia, where so far at least Russia has been totally unmoved by American entreaties, or U.S. Talking to Israel about Gaza or anything else. It suggests that if you stand up to the United States, we're either so anxious for a deal that we'll back off, or what we say essentially is our first word rather than our last word.
So, you know, the White House says that President Trump is optimistic, and he says that he and China's President Xi have a good relationship, and he's waiting for him to call. But you cannot help but notice that President Xi is traveling to Vietnam and other Asian countries, you know, as we speak. Now, that trip might have already been in the works, but how do you read that?
Well, in many ways, what the United States is doing is providing opportunities for China to step in, whether it was the cutoff of the Agency for International Development, which creates all sorts of opportunities around the world for China, or now the tariffs. And China is going to represent itself as a more dependable place to do business with. They won't introduce tariffs or sanctions. And my guess is, at a minimum, a lot of traditional American economic partners are going to look to diversify their portfolio and get closer to China.
Yeah, can they really do that quickly, though? I mean, that seems like a hard pivot and a hard thing to do on short term. I mean, I think, you know, the administration's argument then is that, you know, short term pain, long term gain, and that they cannot sort of
pivot that quickly to lose all these markets? What do you just don't buy that?
Well, no, you're right. You can't turn on a dime, but you can pivot. You can decide that in the future you're going to sign new contracts or make substitute arrangements. Also, in the case of China, if these high-level tariffs remain on for any time, they have got to find alternative markets very quickly because they have all these goods they've produced that will no longer be economically competitive here. So my hunch is they are going to be scouring the world for people to buy things so they can offload their inventory.
One concern you've shared here today in your Substack is that you're concerned that the U.S. has positioned itself as an unreliable trading partner. Let us pivot to the United States. This back and forth on tariffs has sent stocks and consumer confidence into some turmoil. What's your biggest concern for the health of the U.S. economy?
At a minimum, we're heading towards stagflation, lower economic growth, potentially much higher inflation because of the tariffs, quite possibly recession, and that would mean higher unemployment, would make it very difficult for business leaders to make any long-term commitments.
Richard Haass is President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. Mr. Haass, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thanks so much for having me.
I do want to mention that NPR has invited President Trump's economic team, including Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, for a conversation about trade policy. The invitation was declined, but it remains open.
Authorities have charged a man who turned himself in after allegedly setting fire to the home of Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro. An affidavit says the man threw homemade Molotov cocktails into the residence at around 2 a.m. on Sunday morning, and he planned to beat Shapiro with a hammer if he found him inside. NPR's Shondalise Duster reports he faces charges that include attempted murder, aggravated arson, and burglary.
Shapiro said during a press conference he is grateful he and his family were evacuated safely from the governor's residence, where they had celebrated Passover Saturday night. He says they are choosing to see light in a moment of darkness.
We celebrated our faith last night proudly, and in a few hours we will celebrate our second Seder of Passover again proudly. No one will deter me or my family or any Pennsylvanian from celebrating their faith openly and proudly.
Pennsylvania State Police say 38-year-old Cody Ballmer was arrested in connection with a fire that began at the residence around 2 o'clock Sunday morning. Ballmer jumped the fence outside the residence, evading troopers who were searching for him, and broke into the residence with a homemade device where he set the fire before fleeing, according to police. Pennsylvania State Police Lieutenant Colonel George Bivens said while they are still looking into a motive for the fire, it is clear that Ballmer had a plan and was inside the residence for less than a minute.
He clearly had a plan. He was very methodical in his approach and moved through it without a lot of hurry.
Governor Shapiro said this act of violence is becoming too common and called for it to end.
I don't give a damn if it's coming from one particular side or the other. Directed at one particular party or another, or one particular person or another. It is not okay, and it has to stop. We have to be better than this.
Shapiro says he spoke with FBI Director Kash Patel, who promised all the resources of the federal government, and he thanked President Trump for his support. Shondalise Duster, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Richard Kind. You've seen him on countless TV shows and films in his 40-year career. Only Murders in the Building, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Spin City, Mad About You, A Serious Man, and as Bing Bong in Inside Out, just to name a few. He's now the announcer and sidekick on Everybody's Live with John Mulaney. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Drexel University, whose cooperative education program positions students to explore future careers and discover their ideal profession before graduation. This is experiential education. More at drexel.edu. And from Cunard, with round trips from Miami to the Caribbean on Cunard's Queen Elizabeth. Guests can dine on flavors of the Caribbean and explore local life on shore in Antigua, Barbados, St. Lucia, and beyond. Learn more at cunard.com. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. Russia still has not agreed to a ceasefire in Ukraine, despite the Trump administration's attempts to end the war. Ukraine says Russian airstrikes on Sunday killed more than 30 people, including two children, in the far east border town of Sumy. President Trump told reporters aboard Air Force One last night without details that Russia made a mistake. Ukrainian military officers say Russia is taking advantage of the uncertainty around negotiations. And as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports, a group of them spent time meeting American politicians, church leaders, and others to dispel what they say are the myths of war.
The end of wars can be the bloodiest time, says Vladislav Sabalevsky, deputy commander of the 3rd Assault Brigade of the Armed Forces of Ukraine. The Trump administration is trying to end the war, he says, and Russia sees a weak point. He says Russia is trying to impose maximum bloodshed to further pressure Ukraine ahead of any peace talks. Sabalevsky is hoping the Trump administration will get tougher with Russian President Vladimir Putin, who he says has been relying on Iranian weapons, help from China and North Korea.
We're fighting like for Western world. We're facing all the problems, all the threats you guys had from not like 30 years, 70 years. We're fighting North Koreans. We're fighting Chinese people. We captured two of them.
On Ukrainian territory, China has accused Ukraine of making irresponsible statements about this and says the Chinese government wants a peaceful settlement to the war and encourages Chinese nationals to stay away from the conflict. Sobolevsky says he's heard about Chinese volunteers fighting on behalf of Russia since the start of this conflict and suspects there are hundreds of them.
One, it's tourists. Another one, it's like student. And it's the usual scenario.
Right.
You have to hire some people because Russians not so motivated to die on battlefield.
Sabalevsky has been touring the U.S. with the Snake Island Institute, a Ukrainian group trying to strengthen ties with the U.S. Military medic Victoria Honcharuk says she often hears Americans say that Ukraine doesn't want the war to end. But she says she was a pacifist working on Wall Street when Russia began its full-scale invasion.
I had the American dream. You know, I lived in Midtown in Manhattan, and it was really good. And I would have been so much happier doing this now, going to private equity now and sipping my expensive cocktails somewhere in Manhattan.
But Russia came close to occupying her hometown 3 years ago.
When this happens, there is no other choice but to stand up to a bully and to protect what matters to you.
Now she's rescuing the wounded or bringing back bodies from the front lines, including soldiers who were teenagers when this war began. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
About 10,000 active duty soldiers are now stationed from the California coast and the Arizona desert to the Texas borderlands. The deployment is part of President Trump's campaign promise to boost border security. Reporter Carlos Morales has more from Far West Texas.
Right now we're on Highway 67.
Apart from the thrum of traffic, it's a quiet afternoon in Presidio, Texas. The town of roughly 6,000 sits along the U.S.-Mexico border. And Aníbal Galindo is rattling off the kinds of traffic the area sees.
There's farmers, there's pacas of hay that come all the time.
But Galindo's also quick to point out a growing presence in Presidio and along the Texas borderlands, the U.S. military. He says he feels uneasy about the deployment of active duty soldiers to his hometown.
I feel like they're basically turning this place into like a military zone or a wannabe conflict zone, when in reality it isn't.
For Galindo, the region already has a strong law enforcement presence, from local and state police to the U.S. Border Patrol and other federal agencies, along with surveillance towers, traffic checkpoints, and a large blimp the government says can detect a suspicious low-flying aircraft within a 200-mile range.
The surveillance is here, so what else do you want?
Presidio is in what the Border Patrol calls the Big Bend sector, a stretch covering more than 500 miles of the Rio Grande, including a handful of other small rural towns and a national park, too. Throughout this area, the Trump administration has deployed some 500 active duty soldiers. And like in other border towns throughout the Southwest, the Army says these soldiers won't be arresting people suspected of being in the U.S. illegally. Major Jared Stefani is leading the Big Bend area deployment.
We'll be at detection and monitoring sites to provide that information to Border Patrol to then go out and do their law enforcement function.
Joe Portillo, an Army veteran, is the top official in Presidio County. He says the military presence is welcomed here, even though apprehension numbers in far west Texas are low.
Presidio never experienced some of the influxes that you saw in San Diego or in Nogales, Arizona, or in Eagle Pass, Del Rio, McAllen, El Paso.
The number of people crossing illegally through this sector was just over 160 in February, according to Customs and Border Protection. Still, Lloyd Easterling, the chief Border Patrol agent for the area, says the Army's presence is needed.
Giving us those additional eyes and ears out there to not only secure the border, but figure out where and when people came through it.
As part of the Army's deployment to this rugged terrain, the military is sending Striker vehicles, a 19-ton armored combat vehicle on eight wheels that has been used in Iraq and Afghanistan. For Lucinda Herrera in Marfa, another small West Texas town in the Big Bend sector, the troops' presence is familiar. The Army was last deployed here in 2018, and before that, during the 1990s.
I mean, we have no control of it. It's the president that sends them down here, and they do what the president says, so they're just doing their job.
Herrera says she's become used to seeing deployments here, and she doesn't believe that will change, no matter who's in the White House.
Even if Trump isn't, like, you know, president or anything, along the way, troops are going to come down. It's always going to be like that.
Right now, the Army says there's no timeline for just how long the deployment will last here and along the southwest border. For NPR News, I'm Carlos Morales in Marfa, Texas.
This is NPR News.
Alrighty, here it goes again. Pop band OK Go is back with a new record, their first in 10 years.
This actually feels like the most comfortable in our skin I think we've ever sounded.
I'm Elsa Chang. We'll hear from OK Go on their latest album and the adjacent possible on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Asian tech stocks bounced back somewhat today after the Trump administration announced it would temporarily exempt electronics such as smartphones and computers from steep tariffs. But NPR's John Ruich reports it's not clear what happens next in the trade dispute between China and the U.S.
China's been pretty consistent. They've projected defiance throughout this. You know, Trump seems to be waiting for Chinese leader Xi Jinping to pick up the phone and call him. That's not how China operates. It doesn't mean that they're not open to discussion, though. Meanwhile, China has taken steps to, you know, gird for these tariffs. One part of that is deepening relations with other countries, in particular neighbors. And it just so happens that Xi Jinping left today on his first overseas trip of the year.
NPR's John Ruich reporting. The Federal Aviation Administration says the company that operated the sightseeing helicopter that crashed in New York City last week has shut down. All six people were killed when the helicopter broke apart and plunged into the Hudson River. New York Senator Chuck Schumer is calling for tighter safety regulations on tour companies, including surprise inspections.
I'm demanding the FAA increase what are called ramp inspections at other helicopter tour companies. A ramp inspection is a surprise inspection. They show up unannounced.
The cause of Thursday's crash has not yet been determined. This is NPR News in Washington. A police affidavit released today said the suspect in the arson at the Pennsylvania governor's residence yesterday had planned to beat Governor Josh Shapiro with a hammer if he had encountered him. Authorities say the suspect entered the home and set off a homemade incendiary device while the governor and his family were sleeping in another part of the house. They were safely evacuated. The celebrated Peruvian writer Mario Vargas Llosa has died at the age of 89. He was a hugely influential figure in the literature and culture of Latin America for decades, and often courted political controversy as well. Willem Marx reports.
During his long career, Llosa published dozens of works translated into dozens of languages, and in 2010, when he was awarded a Nobel Prize for Literature, the judges labeled him a divinely gifted storyteller. He helped shine a spotlight on his continent in what was often an era of repressive politics, and wrote about authoritarian power and often male violence. But shortly after his Nobel Prize win, he told NPR that literature is about more than politics. It's about life in all its dimensions. But he entered the political arena in 1990 as a presidential candidate, and in recent years attracted criticism for comments about feminism and journalism deaths. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marx.
Rory McIlroy of Northern Ireland won the Masters Golf Tournament in Augusta, Georgia yesterday, only the sixth person to capture golf's Grand Slam. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News. In Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from EasyCater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs with online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses. At easycater.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. It was 6 p.m. on a Friday when Tara McKay saw an email from the branch of the National Institutes of Health. It read,
"Research programs based on gender identity are often unscientific, have little identifiable return on investment, and do nothing to enhance the health of many Americans."
McKay leads Vanderbilt's LGBTQ+ policy lab, and she spent her career studying health disparities in these communities. But her federal funding, she'd been informed, was terminated.
I do feel like the negative pieces of this letter, the unscientific thing that your work doesn't benefit the American people, were, you know, included to be mean and to intimidate me into not doing this work. But I'm gonna keep doing it anyway and show that it is scientific and it does benefit Americans.
That email came in February. As of today, she says her lab has lost $10 million in federal funding, and her story is one of so many. The Department of Health and Human Services, which includes NIH, has terminated over 1,000 grants, and the Trump administration has threatened hundreds of millions of dollars in federal funding to universities dedicated to biomedical and other scientific research. The nation's top scientists are calling it a wholesale assault on U.S. science. Today, on the state of the First Amendment, the right from which all rights flow, is the Trump administration using federal funds and executive orders to silence the work of scientists? McKay is technically free to continue her research, but without access to federal data and money, it'll be almost impossible. And she says that may be the point.
I don't feel like someone saying, oh, Tara, you cannot say, like, queer people matter. But more that I can't make the case because those data aren't going to be able to exist. That feels very challenging in terms of really, really valuing free speech, because then it puts whatever I have to say in the opinion bucket as opposed to the science bucket.
Now, Alina Chan says before this administration came to power, not all scientific theories were respected and supported. She learned this during the pandemic, as the world was shutting down and public health officials were trying to understand the origins and nature of COVID-19.
In early 2020, I said that both natural and lab-based hypotheses for the origin of COVID-19 were plausible and had to be considered no matter how likely or unlikely.
The molecular biologist who works at MIT's Broad Institute faced immediate backlash for suggesting the scientific community needed to consider the virus might have leaked from a lab in China.
Some of the leading scientists, they reached out to my employer. They wanted to get me disciplined or fired. I received lots of threats online. The amount of degradation coming from some virologists, it continues even today.
She was called a race traitor, a conspiracist, a right-wing anti-vaxxer.
So in terms of freedom, I was, of course, free, but it didn't protect me from the kind of online harassment, intimidation, and even, I think, professional interference that resulted from me speaking up on this topic.
In the time since, some federal agencies have shifted their positions to favor the accidental lab leak, though much of the scientific community continues to believe the natural origin hypothesis is more likely. Chan says she was shocked by the efforts to shut her speech down when she pushed for the scientific community to consider all possibilities.
When that happens, it makes it really difficult for other scientists to speak up, to point out where the consensus might be wrong. So because of this rigidity in science right now, where everyone's sort of like closing ranks, it's really hard for that to be true freedom of speech.
Today, she says she thinks the backlash against the scientific community from this administration stems, in part, from that time. As scientists tried to understand the virus and public health officials kept changing guidance, as a frustrated population was dealing with masking mandates and school closures.
That trust faded. That glorification of science did start to wear off at the end of the Biden administration. And so now you have this new administration, and they have frequently been portrayed as anti-science, racist, liars, and now they come in, and what do they do with the scientists, right? So obviously there isn't a good relationship there, and obviously this whole scientific enterprise is in trouble.
While Democrats and a lot of the scientific community dismissed the theory at the time, Chan silencing the efforts to censor her were not orchestrated and led by the U.S. government. And almost 2,000 of the nation's top scientists say that's what they think is happening now. They wrote this open letter to the American people.
The quest for truth, the mission of science, requires that scientists freely explore new questions and report their findings honestly, independent of special interests. The administration is engaging in censorship, destroying this independence.
Reading the letter is one of its co-authors, Dr. Ana Diaz-Rue, an epidemiologist at Drexel University.
A climate of fear has descended on the research community.
I asked her why they sounded this SOS warning, as they called it.
We really felt that we had a moral obligation as scientists to speak out and express what we were seeing so that we can hopefully change course. There are research studies that have been terminated. These studies include clinical trials that are ongoing that have implications for the treatments that people will receive. They also include studies to help us prevent the transmission of infectious diseases and prepare for the next pandemic.
Here at Morning Edition, we've been asking a lot about the state of free speech. And as you just read that letter, there was one line that stood out to me. Quote, the administration is engaging in censorship. Can you say more about what you mean by censorship?
One of the things that's been happening, in addition to the arbitrary and sudden termination of a variety of research projects and the firing and resignation of scientists, there has been an explicit or implicit targeting of certain areas of research that are perceived to be counter to the ideology of the current administration. And this is a big problem because science is about exploration, but we can't do that. We can't provide that kind of objective information that can then be considered by others for social action. We can't do that if certain areas are deemed off limits.
Fear, they say, now permeates their community. We asked the Department of Health and Human Services, the National Institutes of Health, and the White House to respond to this open letter and the specific accusations made by these scientists. The White House Deputy Press Secretary, Anna Kelly, responded saying Trump, quote, will continue to fight against censorship while evaluating all federal spending to identify waste, fraud, and abuse. Tomorrow, a conversation with one administrative judge at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission who is speaking up.
It's time for us to embody the civil rights work we were hired to do and honor the oath to the Constitution that we all took.
This is NPR News.
Musician Katy Perry will blast off into space on a Blue Origin rocket next week, but NPR staffers have their own ideas about which celebrities should go to the stars first. Next time on Here and Now.
With everything from groceries to orthodontics, yes, really, available on demand, why not public radio? Make playing NPR or this station part of your smart speaker routine to stay informed on your schedule.
Good morning, I'm Leila Fadil. A woman in the Czech Republic was taking a walk when she came across a stash of silver coins. So she did what I'm sure you would do if you found a bunch of precious metal. She pocketed, she called the authorities. Archaeologists excavated the area and found more than 2,000 coins believed to be almost 900 years old. Czech archaeologists are calling it one of the greatest finds of the last decade. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. 9 out of 10 Americans do not eat enough vegetables. For some, the challenge is the time it takes to make a salad or roast broccoli. But a new TikTok trend aims to make eating your greens super simple. It's called Dinosaur Time. It may sound a little silly, but reporter Sarah Bowden looked into it.
To do Dinosaur Time, you take a handful of plain leafy greens, give them a rinse, and then shove them in your mouth. Perhaps while standing over your kitchen sink. Humans have been eating raw greens for millennia, but one of the first people to do this on TikTok seems to be a former science teacher named Amy Garrett.
I've been trying to eat more greens with every meal recently, and I have figured out like the best life hack for me that works for me, and so I thought I'd show you.
While she eats the greens, the Jurassic Park theme plays in the background. Garrett's TikTok handle is SAHMThingsUp, and she has nearly 50,000 followers. She often reminds them that dinosaur time is not a meal replacement or a way to lose weight. What it is a strategy to add leafy greens to your diet.
I think it's just so easy.
Emma Longstow of Boston says she's already polished off 3 bags of spinach because of dinosaur time and is eating her way through a fourth.
No cleanup, no meal prep needed. Helps with food waste.
Leafy greens are one of the healthiest foods you can eat. They're a rich source of fiber, vitamins K and C, calcium, iron, and research shows they can reduce the risk of certain cancers and heart disease. So who cares if you're getting all of these benefits while pretending to be a giant reptile?
So the first time I was thinking of that scene in Jurassic Park where they're seeing like I think it's like a brontosaurus, the like long neck one where he's like chomping on the trees.
Longstow likes spinach and doesn't mind eating it plain before dinner of mac and cheese or a sandwich. For some people, that would taste disgusting. Which is okay, says Andrea Mathis, a registered dietitian in Alabama.
There are other ways that you can really enjoy spinach instead of eating it by the handfuls.
Mathis suggests blending spinach or kale into a smoothie. You might not even taste it. Or wrap up some leafy greens with lean turkey as a snack.
I also like to add them to omelets. And if you're making a sandwich, I like to substitute the lettuce for spinach leaves sometimes.
She says food should be enjoyable, and parents are sharing on TikTok that dinosaur time is a fun way to get kids to try new vegetables. That doesn't surprise Julie Stefanski, a registered dietitian in Pennsylvania.
Many children won't touch certain foods because it looks wet or how it feels.
And if kids don't want to touch a food, they're not going to eat it. But when pretending to be dinosaurs, kids are touching vegetables they might otherwise avoid, which is a win even if they don't end up eating anything. The important thing is they're exploring a new food.
Giving kids the space to do that on their own is so important in having, you know, a balanced diet.
Stefanski suspects that the popularity of dinosaur time will eventually go extinct. She suggests something that's nearly as easy is microwaving a bag of frozen veggies and throwing a little seasoning on top. But if you're like me and hate doing dishes, dinosaur time might be worth a try. Though I would not recommend starting with arugula, which I found to be a little spicy. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Bowden.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com.
This is NPR News. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Syria's dictator is gone, but more than 130,000 people are still missing. And some of the groups helping Syrian families find answers are dealing with the Trump administration's foreign aid freeze. NPR's Lauren Freyer has more from Damascus.
This used to be your neighborhood?
It's my building.
This pile of,
yes,
of rubble.
Muhammad Ali stands in the ruins of Jobar, a Damascus neighborhood famous for a historic synagogue and for some of the bloodiest battles of the Syrian civil war.
In every building there is a grave. Our family, our friends, our people died here.
He points to mass graves all around him. When the civil war ended late last year,
life again.
Ali hoped to give his dead relatives and friends a proper reburial. He's a civil engineer, and he's brought a backhoe to unearth these mass graves. But an argument breaks out between the medical examiner and government officials about what procedures need to be followed. Syria needs help with stuff like this, unearthing mass graves, collecting evidence for war crimes investigations. But many of the groups with expertise in this rely on U.S. funding and have recently lost it. So when Jobar residents called for help from the White Helmets, Syrian first responders who've been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, they got put on a wait list.
We are overstretched. We're dealing with numerous mass graves, and we need the resources.
The White Helmets deputy leader, Farouk Habib, says the U.S. Agency for International Development was his group's biggest funder. And when the Trump administration dismantled USAID, calling it rife with waste and fraud, the White Helmets lost a $30 million contract out of its $50 million annual budget.
Well, it hinders our survival.
When dictator Bashar al-Assad fled, Syrian prisons sprung open. Government archives littered the streets. One of the people collecting those documents as evidence for possible trials in the future is Fadl Abdulghani.
We have thousands of documents, the names of those arrested, and the date of when those been killed or been moved to a grave, and the name of the perpetrators as well.
Abdulghani runs the Syrian Network for Human Rights, which also lost U.S. funding this year, and thus won't be able to open a new office in Damascus or hire a new researcher to go through all these documents. This is happening at the very moment this work needs to ramp up, says Stephen Rapp, a former U.S. ambassador at large for war crimes who visited Syria in February.
Everybody I talked to in Syria, at every detention facility or at the courtroom in Homs, where 100 people are crammed in the hallways with pictures of their loved ones demanding action, they want that information. Of course, we also need to begin the process of obtaining DNA samples from survivors through swabs of saliva, and then beginning this long process of excavating the mass graves.
The mass grave in Jobar nevertheless remains untouched. The White Helmets and others are asking the Trump administration not to renew a 90-day pause on U.S. foreign aid that expires this month, and help people like Majida Kado, who stands in a Damascus traffic circle with a candle receiving condolences. Kado has five relatives who were disappeared by the Assad regime. Only one of their bodies has been found. There's nothing worse, she says, to be so close to justice after 14 years of war and then to have your pain prolonged. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, Damascus.
Ecuador's conservative incumbent president is declaring victory in yesterday's election. His leftist challenger is claiming fraud. NPR's Carrie Khan reports the election centered on the unprecedented violence in the country as international drug traffickers and local gangs fight for control over lucrative cocaine routes.
The results came in early and decisively on Sunday. With a double-digit lead, electoral officials called the race for President Daniel Noboa. From the small central Pacific Coast town where he has a home, Noboa told supporters in a message broadcast on TV and social media, voters chose the path forward.
En ese camino, dar progreso, dar tranquilidad, dar paz, dar empleo.
The path of progress, peace, and jobs, he said. Noboa, 37 years old, has spent more years in the U.S., he earned three higher education degrees, than in Ecuadorian politics. In 2023, he won a snap special election as a youthful outsider, beating challenger and leftist Luisa Gonzalez. While she conceded defeat 2 years ago, last night she told supporters in the capital, Quito, the vote was rigged.
Porque está haciendo fraude, el más grotesco fraude, y lo denuncio.
They have committed fraud, the most grotesque fraud, and I'm denouncing it publicly, she said, claiming she had different numbers, though she didn't share them. Gonzalez, a protege of former firebrand leftist President Rafael Correa, has demanded a national recount. Front on voters' minds has been the violence overtaking much of Ecuador, especially in the coastal port city of Guayaquil. At a voting center in an upscale neighborhood, private high school teacher Nelson Moncayo says President Noboa didn't have a lot of time to combat the crime.
He could have done way more, but he deserves a second chance.
Moncayo says it would have been too destabilizing for the country to switch presidents after only 2 years. Noboa, a pro-business conservative who has close relations with President Trump, has taken an iron-fist approach to the international traffickers, Mexican, Colombian, and Albanians operating here with local drug gangs. He's declared a state of emergency, sent the army to the streets, and arrested thousands. Across town in a lower-income neighborhood, 29-year-old Maria Cayodo sells roasted chickens.
Lleve los ricos bollos.
She's outside polling station where she cast her vote for challenger Gonzalez. The mother of four says local gang members are pressuring her 12-year-old son to join them. She's worried about the next 4 years under Noboa, who she said has done nothing to stop the violence. When someone makes all these promises and wins, they better make good on their word, she said. Carrie Khan, NPR News, Guayaquil.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
Wasn't happy last night, baby, please believe me. I caught the moon and its light. I walked on the clouds above.